Once again, guys, we just want to welcome you to episode number 3 of our Fireside Chat. We had an opportunity to come down here to Bellarmine University to work out with the wrestling team. And today we really want to talk to Gavin and talk about his story and really share that with you. And so we're excited for you guys to join us. So Gavin, please tell people who you are.
All right, guys. So my name is Gavin Berkeley. I handle, as far as the company, I handle a lot of the media that goes along with that. These guys automatically put it on me because of being the youngest. They think that I know a little bit more about it, but now we've kind of all taken a collective at it, and definitely a learning process. But originally from Western Pennsylvania. I grew up in a really, really small town. I graduated with 78 students. I could probably name them all if you put them all in front of me. And just is a great place to grow up, I'd say. Probably not a great place to be. Just not a lot there, but definitely learned a lot of great values about family and friendship, and just some awesome relationships that I still have to this day that I continue to build upon when I go back home. Big part of my life was sports growing up. Pretty much my entire childhood growing up, it was football, baseball, wrestling. My least favorite at the time was wrestling. Everything about it, from the cutting weight, going to tournaments all day, just couldn't stand it. But I'd been doing it since I was 5 years old. And then as I got older, probably around middle school time frame, I really, really started taking a liking to it because I started seeing, hey, this is one where, you don't really, it's a team sport, but it's very much dependent on the work that you put into it. So you're the only guy out there, and, you got to work harder than the other guy to have the desired end result. With that being said, I still loved, playing baseball all throughout the summer with my friends, and then, playing football as well, going into high school. But I really started to, focus on wrestling. And I would say I was probably, in my opinion, I was okay for where I was at. It was a lot of perspective for sure as I continue to go up in levels, and that's going to be a theme with a lot of what I talk about, is kind of perspective along the way. But that's just a little piece, kind of my background growing up in a small town. A big part of my life was just that, was sports, and it's all year round for me.
So tell us a little bit about your journey into where you are right now, because you talked about your childhood. What got you to this point?
So I would say, so where I'm at right now, I didn't really think too much about the military, honestly, growing up. I knew about it. My dad was in the Navy for 6 years. I'd always known that. We had gone down to the beach, to Virginia Beach, which was a place we always went on a family vacation every year. We go, seeing the jets fly over, going to Norfolk, seeing the aircraft carriers, because that's what my dad had served on. So that was kind of like my introduction to it. But going through, I wanted to. To be a Division I athlete. That was a strong, a desire that I had. Originally, I thought I really wanted to be, Division I. I wanted to play football somewhere. I would probably say that was probably what I was best at, in my opinion. But just very, very small school, and you see kind of a bigger fish in a small pond. But definitely, I had to put myself out there with that being from a small town. So I'm like, if I'm going to play at the next level, I gotta get my name out there. I ended up, starting off my career in wrestling. It was very, I think my first year, my freshman year, I wrestled at 140 pounds, and I was 15 and 16 as a freshman. You know, and I was bumping around. My high school coach always loves to tell that story about, you know, I had to, you know, having to bump up sometimes one or two weight classes, depending on the match, what was better for the team. And then, you know, my sophomore year went up. I was a 160 pounder, I believe. Got a little bit better. I had a winning record, but you know, I still didn't advance to even our regional tournament. You know, I take a lot of pride in being from Pennsylvania. It's a very, you know, it's known for its wrestling, but and just great competition in general. And then going into my junior year, that was when I finally broke through. Ended up winning a district title, making it to regionals, and then qualifying for the state tournament. I got fifth at the region, and they took the top five. So kind of got that first feel, and then, you know, going into the senior, to my senior year, I had my sights set on a state title, and I knew, like, this is probably going to be my avenue to going to, you know, to get into the next level, to going to school. I was a pretty good student, but again, relatively speaking, you know, I did okay in school, but then, you know, when I had to take my standardized tests, I think I took the SAT about five times. At least I took the SAT, or I took the ACT, I think, you know, another three times. But one of my really close mentors, he, you know, he's my dad's wrestling coach, and then, you know, he was always in the room with us. His both of his sons went to West Point, and I didn't know too much about it, honestly. I had gone through to some little local events they have for the service academies, and I was like, okay, like, you need a congressional nomination, you know. I was like, I gotta, you know, find out about that. You have to have, usually your SAT scores need to be here. And that was extremely intimidating, because I'm like, okay, that's, I have a lot of work to do there. My GPA was fine, but I mean, pretty much, you know, you show up to class and, you know, it's, and do your homework. It's, you can have a good GPA, essentially. But definitely I knew that, you know, having, from what I heard, like, both of his sons were wrestlers, and he's like, hey, you know, we'll try and get you recruited athletes, have a way better shot of getting in. So going into my senior year, I had a few schools interested. I'd taken visits, a few for football and a few for wrestling. I was very interested in going to the University of Maryland. At first, I pretty much all but committed, and then I really wanted to go to the Naval Academy. That was my thing, but they didn't have any interest. I was like, I want to be a Navy SEAL too. Like, that's what I want to do. You know, you see all the movies and everything and the books about them. So I'm like, oh, that's what I want to do. I'd like to do that. And, but you know, I still tried. Once they kind of showed, hey, you know, thanks but no thanks, went to their little summer seminar thing they had. I think it was like, I was just about ready to fully commit to Maryland, and then Coach Young, Coach Paul Young, who is a guy actually that I got to see him about 2 weeks ago at a wedding, the first time I'd seen him, you know, since he was a coach, he reached out to me and said, hey, like, you know, you got accepted at the prep school. So I was like, okay, well, I guess that's good. He's like, you know, you can go there for a year, and pretty much if you don't get in trouble and, like, you don't completely, you know, fail out of the classes, like, you'll get your appointment to the academy. And luckily, like, my mentor, his son had done that as well, and, you know, spoke very highly of it. And I was like, all right, sign me up. I think I went, as soon as I heard that same day, I went on, like, the portal, and I signed up. And then, yeah, I was like, that summer I was heading out there to their version of basic training, and ended up meeting, you know, some of the, you know, my best friend, the best friends that, you know, I could ever imagine having. That was probably one of the most fun years we had. Just kind of first time really being away from home. It was also one of the best years being there, because, you know, we could have a car, whereas when you're actually there, you can't have a car until your junior year. You know, you got paid as a, you know, a PB2. So, you know, after, you know, not having to pay for school and then having that, yeah, you're considered a PB2 when you're there. So that was pretty cool. So we traveled all around, you know, and then also I got to go wrestle with the team. They called it Down the Hill. So
you know, got to get my butt kicked a little bit down there and get a taste of you know, Division I wrestling. And then, yeah, that next year, you know, graduated prep school, got down and went down the hill and, you know, started my plebe year the next year. Luckily, it was with that group of guys that that started, you know, that were there with me at the prep school, so it made it kind of a little bit easier. You know, gnash my teeth through that kind of, you know, going through that. Because I was definitely not the best student by any means, but you know, it's made a lot of good relationships. I had some great professors, and they're very much about helping you down there. Kind of, if you put the effort in, you know, they're not gonna let you fail, really. So it wasn't easy. You know, adding wrestling on top of that was, you know, it was difficult. It's something that, like, you know, we talked to the guys today a little bit at Bellarmine University. It was great getting to talk to the athletes there. I think it kind of, there were times you have regrets a lot. A close friend of mine said, you know, he talked about the definition of resilience, and it's like, and he described it as, you know, you have regrets about the things like you didn't do, but then it's also like the things that you did well too. Like, man, like, yeah, you did this well, but you know, it could have been done better. Like, what if it happened a different way? And it's something that kind of leave, it's just something that's in your head that sticks with you, you know, especially competing on a stage like that. It was definitely a new perspective for me. I was like, okay, I was kind of a bigger fish in a small pond, and then you know, there, you know, I'm, you know, in the room getting my butt kicked, and I'm like, you know, this is the real deal. This is the show. And ended up being a 4-year backup, I kind of fell out of love for the sport at times. When you're trying to balance everything, you're balancing school, you're balancing wrestling at the same time. There were some, you know, other things going on, like militarily. You know, I was, you know, in my junior or my sophomore year, I tried out for the, you know, combat diver qualification course. So I was in there doing all that while wrestling in school. I learned so much from that year. Probably, I was in great shape, but I remember getting sick a lot and like missing class quite a bit because I was like just trying, my body just couldn't keep up with it. But I learned a lot about myself from that experience and getting the opportunity to go to that school that summer. It ended up not working out for me. I was a safety violation, and I was very crushed after that. And it took me a long time to get over it, but ended up finishing it out. Something that was, and I told the guys about it today, was every year before the Navy match, we had a letter that we'd read that Tommy Hendricks, he was a former Green Beret, and I think he was an 05 grad. He wrote this letter about, he was a 4-year backup like me, and he said, you know, what wrestling taught me was how to suffer, and it set me up for anything I could do. Like anything else I was gonna do in my life, in my military career, I had an advantage. I felt that I had an advantage because I knew how to suffer where other people didn't. He was comfortable in the suffering. Like, he thrived in that. And I think that's just like, that ode is something that every wrestler can kind of relate to, and that it's something that I tried to, you know, to relate to those guys. But fast forward, I ended up making it through. I branched infantry. I was, you know, pretty low in the class. I think I was 918 of like 1,080 cadets, but nonetheless got to walk across the stage. And then the next thing up was, going down to Fort Benning, now Fort Moore, for basic officer course, Ranger School and Airborne School. And then where I initially got introduced to Chad down there. We had a good crew of guys, and we were very close-knit. It was a much simpler times where, you know, there weren't a lot going on. It was weekend warriors, you know, living for the weekend. You're out in the field, and then you just go out and, you know, have fun on the weekends, and it wasn't too stressful. After that, you know, ended up going to, once Bullock was over, went to Airborne School, finished, and then went to Ranger School. Ended up failing my first time going. And then getting an opportunity to come back. That's when COVID hit too, so we were kind of in a lockdown. And so I'm like, you know, they say like there's never a good time to go. I was like, no, I think that's the exception. It was a good time to go because literally nothing's going on in the world. And you were just there, like essentially in a quarantine already. So I went there in April of 2020 and ended up doing a little extra time there after recycling Darby phase, which is I needed it for sure. And then ended up in July, ended up graduating then and coming back. I think I probably lost around, you know, 20 to 30 pounds total.
You gained it back, that's good.
Definitely gained it back, for sure, quite easily. And then it was off to Fort Stewart after that, Fort Stewart, Georgia. I was very fortunate when I got down to Fort Stewart. I ended up kind of taking a platoon right away. I moved in initially. You know, my girlfriend at the time had moved down and was, you know, already had a teaching job set up and had found like a beautiful home down in Porter, you know, about 45 minutes away. And so I was looking forward to getting down there. And then went down there, and pretty much as soon as I got there, we ended up going to Korea for 9 months, which, you know, you think I would have done a little bit of research into that. Like, hey, where's the unit going? I didn't know. I was like, I didn't realize they were going to. I was like, oh, maybe I won't go because I got here late. And as you guys all know, this is not how it works, really. You know, they're going to get their people over there. But fortunately, I had an amazing team, amazing platoon that I got to lead with some guys that I'm, you know, I still talk to today and that are out doing great things, whether they're still in or out now. And then came back from that 9 months, was home for about 5 or 6, ended up going out, moving, buying a house, a brand new house, and I transitioned from my platoon leader position to a 2XO, and then Russia-Ukraine happened about 4 or 5 months after that, and they decided that we were, you know, the most ready show of force to go over there, and so we were going to Germany for what was supposed to be 3 months, and so that was quite an experience going over there, a lot of uncertainties and unknowns, and it ended up being 6 months total. Mm-hmm. So definitely a lot of adversity. I saw a lot of people go through some things over there. While we were there, I saw people kind of struggling, you know, and with their family struggling, you know, with dealing with all the uncertainties, and, you know, people that I was working with every day, and then, yeah, ended up coming back. It was August then, August of 22 is when we ended up getting back finally. And then got back. So some things had kind of been up. When I go into kind of my story, there's things that I explain. I like to make it clear that it's one of accountability. But I feel like to properly tell my story, I have to kind of tell you to get into the headspace that I was in, and just kind of how I got to the position that I was in. I noticed some things before I came home. Moving out of Fort Stewart, ended up before I went to Korea, got engaged, got married right before going to Korea. And then, you know, a few reasons for that, obviously, you know, making sure your spouse is taken care of. We kind of talked about it. We're both like, okay, this is probably a good idea, you know, just in case, especially if you want to move jobs or something like that. So we ended up doing that, and then obviously a lot of uncertainties with being gone. You know, not a lot of guys were gone for 15 months, you know, after, you know, going to their first duty station. That's like, especially guys that were in my year group. But I noticed the closer I got back, I kind of had less and less communication. You know, it's harder and harder to communicate with my spouse. and just I didn't know what was up. And obviously, communication is a two-way game, so it's not like, you know, I'm obviously at some blame for that, but but I felt like, okay, this is very weird. And then you know, received some messages that, like, you know, I was like, okay, this sounds rough, like. So, like, it's not something to talk about over text. I was like, I had a pretty sinking feeling. And I was like, all right, well, you know, maybe if we see each other, it'll get better. And I got home, you know, I got to meet up with our pup. We had, my pup was, you know, my best friend. Like, I gotta explain, he's super happy to see me. It was like, even being gone that long, it was like, he still remembered me. And things were pretty normal for a week. And then it was you know, a week after that, you know, my spouse sat me down and was kind of like, you know, I've done a lot of thinking, and, you know, I think that, you know, I'm not sure about being married. I know in the military you got to move and stuff. I'm, you know, just saying, like, how she's very comfortable where she's at and career oriented. And I didn't take it well. I did not take it well. And I felt like it was a state of disbelief. Like, I did not feel like, I felt like I was living in some sort of dream, just waiting for somebody to smack me and wake me up and be out of it. But it wasn't a dream. And, you know, the next few weeks and months, I reached out to, you know, somebody that I was with. A lot of that was Nick, you know, our teammate. We were trying to really be there for one another and sharpen each other, and be like, hey, man, you know, think you gotta look at some things. You gotta look at is, like, you know, look at your ego. Like, you know, your ego might be getting in the way. And like I talked to these guys earlier today about it. Like, yeah, there were some things with me. I think one of the reasons I was in disbelief, I was like, man, like, I'm this, you know, I'm a West Point grad. I was a Division I athlete, Army wrestler. Like, I'm not gonna get divorced. Like, I don't do that. Like, that's not gonna be me. You know. I, you know, throughout my childhood, I mean, like, I don't think they mind me saying it, you know, because, you know, that I'd say it in front of them too. It's like, you know, I felt like, you know, I saw my parents fight a lot, and it was something that it did mess with me. You know, I love them both very much, and, you know, I know that, you know, they would do anything for me, but, you know, when you see that, it is tough. And I always thought, like, oh, man, they, like, if they didn't get divorced, like, I don't fight like that. Like, I'm gonna be fine. And so I'm like, well, maybe, you know, I gotta figure out some stuff about myself. Maybe there's something getting in the way. And I did try to take a step back, and, you know, I let some time go by. And one thing that was said is, like, you know, I need time. And then I said, you know, I respect that you need time, but one thing I can't promise you is that I'm not gonna start to go. You know, I'm going to grow resentful after a while because I'm human. And, you know, time continued to go, and you know, it got to a point, you know, I was living in a roommate-type state in my home. And, you know, I had, you know, a lot of really great friends, and I consider myself extremely blessed with the brothers and friends I have in my life, and people being like, man, like, that's not healthy, like, how you're living like that. You know, living in a state like that. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I was like, kind of, you know, shrugged it off. And, you know, I turned to other things. I had this void in my life. And I was like, you know what? I'm gonna drink. The funny thing about drinking is, you know, it will take your mind off of it for a little bit. And then it's like it's on steroids. It'll amplify it. And by the slightest thing, the slightest reminder of something, and then it's like you're in some sort of state, you know, emotional state, you know, where you're crying, you're angry, whatever, and it just amplifies all that. And, you know, I turned to that, and I got to a point where I was like, you know, if we're unable to reconcile this, like, I'm going to go try to fill that void elsewhere. And, you know, I spent my weekends, you know, going downtown, you know, trying to talk to girls, you know, whatever. I didn't know how, really, because I was like, I've been in this relationship, you know, for 12 years between dating and being engaged and married, and, you know, and it's like, and I'm still married, technically, but I'm still going downtown and acting like I'm completely single, because that's how I choose to fill this void in my life. And, you know, I'm using alcohol as a tool to do that. I'm going hanging out with my friends, and then after the weekend's over, I come back to living in that house, in that space, cross the threshold into that. And it was just like an altered state of reality. And obviously, you know, unsustainable. And, you know, one of the things I always thought is, like, especially being a man of faith, you know, I had this void in my life, and I'm going to these other things. I'm trying to do the right thing. I was trying to, you know, I consider, you know, I'm a Christian. I consider myself a man of God, and, you know, I'm trying. I'm not practicing what I'm preaching now. You know, I'm going out and doing these things, and again, like I said, keep saying this, I was filling this void in the wrong places. Meanwhile, I'm trying to accomplish my dream at the time, which, you know, I was like, I talked about wanting to be a Navy SEAL. One of the things, you know, that obviously didn't happen, but I wanted to, it was like the next best thing. I want to be a Green Beret. I tried out to, I had interviewed for Ranger Regiment when I was a lieutenant. I was in Korea, and I interviewed for it, and it went really well. And I was looking for it. I was like, and even talking to my battalion commander at the time, he was like, man, I think it looks good. He had reached out, the XO of the first bat had reached out to him and was like, hey, he interviewed really well. It's hard to assess, you know, junior officers. Like, what would you say? And he was like, you need to hire him for sure. He's great. So I usually never got too excited about that stuff, because I knew, like, how things can, you know, it doesn't always plan out that way. And it ended up, you know, about 6 weeks later, yeah, sorry, we encourage you to reach out elsewhere. But I wanted to, I was like, hey, it's kind of all eggs in that basket, because, you know, it's local and everything, that if not, I'm going to have to, you know, move back up to Benning or go to the West Coast. And so, you know, that didn't work. I was like, you know, I want to be a Green Beret. Like, that's what I'm meant to do. Army wrestlers do that. My teammates, you know, they are the tip of the spear guys. They're SEALs, they're Rangers, they're Green Berets. And, you know, that's like, felt like that's what I'm supposed to do. That's my purpose. So I was very ready for that. I had been training since I was in Germany. I put, you know, just an immense amount of time into that. And then, so I'm still dealing with all these other things. But then I go in October. I'm very, very well prepared, I feel. And then, you know, get to land nav, and I get too close to a road at night, and then still ended up finishing it. And then when they have that formation, you know, after it's over, you know, you hear your roster number called, and you just, that sinking feeling in your stomach. It was very similar to the feeling I got, like, talking about, you know, those text messages before I came back from Germany. And I was just devastated. You know, you spend your time in the tent city then, and you're just kind of basking in your sorrow with the other guys there. And, you know, I came back, and I remember getting some phone calls from some really close friends, you know, and just, like, brought me to tears. My one buddy, you know, my buddy Andrew was, I remember him calling me and being like, I told him what happened. And he's like, dude, you're the toughest dude I know. And I burst into tears. Mm-hmm. I was like, man, it's tough. I was like, but, you know, I'm gonna press on. You know, I placed a lot of my identity in that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I got back, and then kind of went back in that same thing. I was back into the reality. But fortunately, in January came around, and I was like, I got a call back, and I didn't know who it was from. I saw that it was from Knox, and I was like, okay. And I took it, and it was the future readiness officer for SF, and he was saying, like, hey, we saw that you came in the October class, and, you know, I know that things didn't go well, but, you know, I'm reading good things about you. We have you on a list here, some guys that we think if you came back that you'd have success. So, like, when could you come back? And I was like, you know, I almost dropped me to my knees. I was like, because I remember calling Chad about it right after the time, and he could hear it in my voice. That's something he told me. Like, man, I hear it in your voice, how excited you are. I was like, yeah, I just got eye surgery. I need to wait a few more months until, like, I don't need to, you know, until I'm kind of clear. He's like, all right, we'll set you up for April. So I was very excited. I jumped right back into training. And, you know, he's getting after it, you know, twice as hard. But something felt a little off about it. I was like, I still feel like I was almost using that, using like that as an escape from my situation.
Okay.
And you know, I was like, I'm just using this as kind of like, hey, it's getting, I'm forgetting about, you know, my situation at home. And then this, like, you know, search for wanting and wanting to be loved. Like, the only time I really felt wanted or be loved was I went through the door and my dog was there to see me and excited and jumped up on me and gave me a hug. But yeah, it kind of all came to fruition, you know, only weeks before going to selection. You know, I went down to Savannah with my friends for a weekend, and Sunday rolled around and we're like, they had all kind of gone their separate ways, and I was like, the last thing I want to do is go back home. So I decided to go down to the beach, and I was like, I'm gonna go to this one spot that's open late. And, you know, I'm gonna continue this party and continue this escape from reality. Was there for, I don't know how, I was with complete strangers that I didn't even know. I was like, you know, what am I doing here with these people? I don't even know. Like, I'm just, you know, trying to fit in. And then the next moment that I remember after that was waking up to a blinding light, being pushed on a bed in a hospital, people in masks, and like opening up to, it wasn't, you know, you hear the stories about people opening up and, you know, seeing heaven, being exposed to a glimpse of heaven, and it was very bright, but it was definitely not heaven. It was sheer terror, as how I would describe it. It is complete unknown of, I didn't know where I was, what, you know, how I got there. I have blood all over me, my, you know, clothes were ripped up, and I just, you know, I'm strapped to this bed. But I had left there at the time and drove over an hour back, and was on I-95 in the opposite lane of oncoming traffic. Ended up hitting a van, a 12 passenger van, and then right after that hitting a tractor trailer head on. I was, from going back and reading the police report, you know, I was unresponsive at the scene, and it was hours later that I even was conscious and, you know, remember anything. And in that, I had harmed other people, and I didn't find out till later, from my father, who came down to visit me, that he's like, do you remember anybody being with you? And I was like, I know Bo was with me, my dog. And he's like, yeah, he was with you. And I could tell, I knew it right away that it had happened. And it's hard to even, I just remember just my breath going away, just hyperventilating and kind of, I don't think I cried at the moment. I didn't think I had anything in me to cry. Mm-hmm. But at that time, I just like remember it, and especially that night when, you know, when my dad had to go back to his hotel, just thinking like, crying out to God, like, you know, you took the thing that showed me love, the only thing that I looked forward to coming home to, you know, my dream is now shattered. You know, I hurt other people, and like, my career's over. I know that. Mm-hmm. And like, why didn't you kill me? Like, why am I, like, you making me suffer through this, sitting on here? I don't know if I'm gonna be able to walk again. I don't know if I'm gonna be able to run again. I had a rod through my knee, and I didn't know at the time, my hip was completely shattered, and I was supposed to get reconstructive hip surgery in a few days, and I just couldn't move, just strapped to this bed. But in the days following, you know, just surrounded by so much love, the people coming to see me, and I think about one of the things we talk about here on our team is, you know, who are the five people in your corner? Who are the people in your corner? You know, we try to do things alone. And it's like, who are those people you can depend on? And it's just like some of my old teammates, some of my best friends in the world coming there, them and their spouses, and like coming there and holding my hand. Like, when I wouldn't blame them if they didn't. Like, I didn't deserve that. But you know, I was like, I must have shown them, you know, this form of love that they able that they were able to reciprocate that to me. And then Chad walked through the door, which was, I was talking to guys, like, he actually drove down from around here. He was in Kentucky at the time, and ended up driving the 8 hours down to spend a few hours with me, and seeing that the state that I was in. And then, you know, I was there for a little over a week, and then, you know, had to, you know, do get surgery, go through, you know, CT scans and everything. Ended up getting out, and then had some really good friends at the time that I was with that took me in, and I went and immediately lived with them. The days that followed were, you know, some of the very, very darkest of my life. You know, all the uncertainties, and, you know, we talk about you know, suicide is very prevalent in today's world. And I was a person that I would have judged people for that, you know, back then. I was like, oh, it's just, you know, some people were just, you know, weak people. I was like, that's not me though. I'm a pretty resilient guy. Like, you know, wrestled my whole life. You know, I'm this, you know, this army officer, I'm this infantry guy, ranger. Like, I'm, you know, that's not me. And it's like the places your brain can take you to when you're alone. You know, it's a feeling of complete hopelessness. And I know other people on our team have struggled with this, and that's the scary thing, is getting to a place where you're like, I'd be better off not being around anymore, and convincing yourself that everybody else that you know would also be better off without you here, which is the furthest thing from the truth. You know, we all have people that depend on us. But some time had gone by, and there's another thing too. You know, talking to my dad there, and, you know, my dad and I love my dad, and him and I have had, we've had a lot of fights throughout the years. There's definitely a lot of things. He's a very stubborn guy. I don't think he'll mind me saying that. I think he knows. He's a guy that it's you know, it's hard to earn his trust. If you have him as a friend, you have him as a friend for life, but he's hard to get along with at times. But he said something to me that really, I mean, I knew he loved me, but it really proved that he loved me. He told me, you know, if you would have, he said, and going back to you know, talk about, you know, taking your life, he's like, if you would have taken somebody else's life in that, he's like, I would have killed you in that hospital. He said, I would have found a way to, you know, while you're sleeping or something. But, you know, how do I explain that sounding like that's a place of love? Because he knew what I would do had that been the case. If I would have been able to live with taking somebody else's life, and I would have, you know, as a man of faith, you know, it's like, you don't take your own life. You know, your life is a gift. You know, it's a gift from God.
And it may not have sounded at the time like it was something that, but in his mind at the time, he was thinking of that in a merciful way, because he knew you would have done it yourself.
Absolutely, and that's why I explained this. That was one of the greatest showings of love, for him to say that, for him to love me to the point where he's like, I love you so much that, you know, I couldn't picture you taking your own life, so I would have taken, you know, yeah. I would have taken the consequence for that. It's very tough to explain, but I think it's something important to explain, because I think, you know, it goes into that. But, you know, I think it was a few months had gone by, maybe two to three months, and Chad had called me. He's always keeping in contact. You guys know how he keeps in contact.
Yeah. It's been 5 o'clock every morning.
Yeah. So, he had called me. I knew he always kind of talked about the idea of what is now Beyond the Track. And he talked about really wanting to start it up, something to make a difference, and something that, you know, is able to give back and, you know, teach people how to be better for those who depend on them. Because, you know, you see so many examples of people, you know, that, like, you know, they got too much going on in life. You know, they have a higher standard for others than they have for themselves. And so they're like, yeah, no, you know, it's like they don't lead themselves first.
And I'm like, the only thing I can think of, I was like, that sounds great, brother, but why are you talking to me about it?
Like, you know what's funny is all of you had the same reaction. You're like, that's cool, dude.
Why?
Yeah. Why? Same thing. Why are you calling me?
What do you want?
Because I called you, that's why.
What do you want from me?
You're the only number I had in my phone.
No. Yeah, I was like, you
actually don't have any other numbers.
I was like, he must just be trying to make me feel better or something, but I was like, you know what? Maybe this is a sign. You know, I'd identified so much of my identity was like, you know, I'm supposed to go do this thing. I'm supposed to go be, this is God's plan for me. I'm supposed to go be a Green Beret. I was giving that up, this second opportunity because of that. And then, you know, your whole world gets halted. You know, boom, I'm divorced now. I don't really have a home. I'm not going to have a job in the near future. And he's asking me to be a part of this team. Like, you know, I'm in the eyes of the world, I'm a criminal in the eyes of the world. Like, you know, that's that my identity, what I thought I once was, all of that had changed. And that's where my mind took me. I was convinced of that, you know, this is who I am now. Like, this is who I am. I don't think that's who I am. I know that's not, you know, the true person. But like, on the eyes of the world, seeing me on paper, seeing me in the news, you know, that's who I am. You know, after a while, I, you know, finally went back to work, you know, on crutches. That was a very difficult experience going in there with the looks that you get from people. And I will say, you know, I was received well, you know, and again, nobody had to do that, but I was, you know, that was a humbling experience to like see like, hey, you know, we're not going to look at you anything. And the thing is, I heard things from people that, you know, I was close to, and about hearsay, people talking about, you know, stuff behind your back. And it's like, all right, that's, yeah, it definitely hurt me, but it's like, I get why they said that. I mean, until you know somebody's story and you've walked a mile in your boots, it honestly, what that did for me is like, that's good to know, because I was that person at some point. I used to be that person. It's like, idiot, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. Like, are you, yeah, like, it, and then now I'm in that seat, and I'm like, okay, I have an opportunity to display forgiveness and immaturity, or I can keep living in this and do nothing about it. We, you know, our name in general, we had some guys asking today, Beyond the Track, why is it Beyond the Track? And, you know, I love what Chad says about that. It's like, you know, you're not the sum of your past mistakes or your successes. It's whatever happens in your life, be it good or bad. It's like what you do beyond that is what defines you and what people are going to remember you by. Your family, there are people that depend on you. Whether you're a boss, whether you're a coach, whether you're a husband, a father, there's people that directly depend on you. You know, and so it's not just about you. When it goes in that, it's like, what can you take to ensure that, you know, this is not your story? And so I was like, I can live in this, or I can choose to use what I've learned, because the crazy thing is that there's people out there living your story. This is something that I've heard Chad talk about. I've heard all you guys talk about. I was like, there's somebody out there living my story. Or they're in a place where they could live my story, because they're going through the things that I went through and on the path of destruction that I was on. And, you know, if I can stop one person from doing that by being vulnerable and explaining, like, hey, you know, this is where I was in life, and accepting that accountability, but, you know, I'm not defined by this. And, you know, and I know, you know, in my faith, by my faith, that's not, I'm not defined. That's not who God knows me as. That's, you know, as my own flesh, how I try to, you know, I get down on myself, and I have my days, still have my days. I was just talking to Chad about, you know, in the hotel the other night, I was like, yeah, you know, a little bit rougher night for me for some reason. You know, I think we're just thinking about everything, you know, having to talk about, knowing that I was going to talk about stuff, but, you know, I talked a lot there, so.
I mean, the reason I ask is, what happens is, you know, you see interviews and people like cut through, and I just wrote, you know, there's some other questions I have. But before we get into those questions, we want to really take a break and give a word from our sponsors.
Jordan Smith. I'm announcing right now, Downrange Supplements is in your local commissary. If you're anywhere near a base and you have base access, get to the commissary and check out our pre-workout, our rehydration BCA formula, and our protein. I promise you, you will not be disappointed. It is the best in the market. Enlist A9 Fight Company, my brand, is partnered with Downrange Supplements for a reason. And I tell you, their products work. And also, don't forget, we kill suckers.
Guys, welcome back. As we continue, I know Gavin went in extreme detail, which is really great on your story, but there's some things that I wanted to go back to that I think really identify some of that resiliency that you were able to build. And you had talked about when you were at West Point, combat diver training taught you a lot about yourself. What is it that it taught you? What did you learn about yourself that you didn't know from the mat that you learned from combat diver that you actually apply it today?
Oh man, I mean, it taught me a lot, and it was another one of those things that, like, it was a failure, but I was very much caught up in that badge. Like, you know, the bubble, all that looks cool. I want that. I see the guys with that. That's what I want. But the whole thing about it was like, and we talk more coaching people, like, it's not the end result. It's not the wins and losses. Like, it is the journey that got you there. That journey is what the benefit that I got from that was.
Okay.
You know, it was funny because, like, every Thursday night we'd do stress inoculation night. And I had never passed out before in anything. And that was a pretty new experience for me. You know, being underwater and then waking up on the pool deck with, you know, somebody put an oxygen, you know, tube on me, you know. Like, it, but I think the other guys loved it because they got a break after it happened. So they were depending on me to do that. Everybody's depending on me. After the first few times, I knew, like, hey, it's Thursday night, it's going to be a rough night. But you know what? It was literally that, you know, you push yourself to a point on the wrestling mat when you get extremely tired. There's no other sport that puts you through that level of fatigue. But, you know, doing something to the point where, okay, you're literally till you pass out. If you don't get pulled out, then you drown. You know, but we had, you know, nobody was going to let that happen. It kind of showed me my limitation. Like, you know, you are capable of so much more from a physical standpoint, for sure, than you can imagine. At the same time, I'm balancing college wrestling, I'm balancing school, which, you know, school was hard enough for me. Organizational psychology, I'm pretty sure they made that major up for me, practically, organizational psychology and leadership, you know, leadership major at West Point. My friends will watch this and they'll laugh because they always joke with me about it. Like, but that's what I needed to graduate. I needed numbers was not my thing. I needed help with all that stuff. But, you know, I was able to get through all of it while doing that. And, you know, I had some amazing mentors. Some of the guys on the team at the time were guys that were cadre for it that had already done it. And just, like, seeing how they carried themselves, like, the humility they have. And, like, all those guys now are, you know, they're out team leaders somewhere. And just, you know, people that are still just very close brothers to me. It taught me a lot about myself, about my physical limitations. And just about, you know, a lot of the stuff you did in there was team-based stuff. Like, a brick push with a buddy where you have to have somebody's on that brick the entire time and you're pushing it 50 meters, like, you're down, you know, you're down there holding it. If you're up on the surface taking a bunch of air, like, your buddy's down there suffering. And just, like, you know, I talked about wrestling, you know, really teaching you how to suffer. It was just an addition of suffering. It's like, how can you get a PhD in suffering? Like, wrestling Division I at West Point while doing combat dive training, while trying to, you know, drag your knuckles through, you know, your school coursework, that can get you pretty close to a doctorate in suffering, I think, for sure. And, you know, who knows if I don't have those experiences, you know, in my future, you know, how I'm able to respond to things.
When we talk about the feeling, right? That was one thing we talked about with these kids. It's like, winning or losing doesn't matter, but the feeling you get from it, the high you get from winning because you put in the hard work, or the guilt and just everything that comes with losing, you remember that.
Yeah.
You remember that, and that's what propels you forward. I mean, to your point, like doing all those hard things, you can always look back on those and you're like, well, whatever I'm about to do right now is not going to be bad as Thursday night. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not going to be a new thing. It, whatever I'm going to do right now will not be bad as Thursday night.
Yeah.
Stress this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I can resonate with that, you know, like combat diver, because I went to preschool, but that was the only school that I failed. And I was like, where I passed it, but I didn't pass to the point where like, hey, we're going to send you out of combat diver school. Yeah, of course not. Yes. So, but I understand that. You talked about the regret that you experienced with success. You know, what was that regret? Because you said it was success and you were successful, but you could have done it better. What was the regret really about?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I'm a big visualizer. I'm always looking at things, you know, from different perspectives, and I think, like, I have a vision of something in my head, how it's supposed to go, you know. I could have been very, very happy, you know, with, oh, man, I got a chance to wrestle at the Division I level, like, you know, what percentage of Americans, you know, get to do that. I got to, you know, I placed in the state of Pennsylvania, and I was as the first medal in 25 years, but it was just the feeling I had after. I was like, man, like, I could. What if I win this match? I'm in the finals, or you know, I'd have been a champion. You think about the what could have been. It could have been their successes, but then also, you know, like what could it have been? What a little switch here. You know, the Titanic turns a degree or two, and it misses the iceberg. So it's a tough question to answer, but I think. Because it's like, yeah, it's still a success, but, you know, you have this vision, and if it doesn't live up to your vision of what it is, it's like, you know, that can cause some regret.
Okay. That's good. So, I mean, this is, I guess, a little deeper question to ask you. You spoke about your high school sweetheart that you married, you with her for some time. And you said there were some things that were going on, and you talked about text messages when you're in Germany. Do you mind sharing, like, what were the nature of those text messages that made you feel like, hey, some things are off here?
Yeah, so, like I said, it was not a lot of communication. And when I say all this, I don't have any animosity towards her.
Okay.
I want her to be happy, and I wrote her a very long letter. That was, you know, I was Nick, actually. He advised me, he's like, I think you should do this. And I think he may have done the same to his wife. And so I did that, and I poured my heart into that, and I ended it with, you know, if, you know, you said you don't want a family, but if someday you change your mind and you do want that, it's not with me, I'll be happy for you. It's very tough to write that on paper. It's like, man, do I really mean that? But she just said some things. She's like, you know, it was something along the lines, like, you know, having a lot on her mind, you know, this not really being something she wanted to talk about over text. And then, you know, it was something about, you know, I didn't know when the right time was, you know, because she was saying it as, like, worried about me going over, you know, I don't want to drop these feelings I have on you before you're going over to a very unknown situation where you're in a position of leadership. You're company XO of an infantry company. My response, I was like, that would have been the best time to tell me. If we would have went to war, I wouldn't have cared about coming back, you know, which obviously is not the right answer. It's an extremely immature way to look at it. But, you know, afterwards, that's kind of how I responded when I got back. I was like, oh, you should have told me then, because I wouldn't have cared about coming back at all, you know. It would have given me a reckless abandon, which I think everybody would agree that's pretty terrible leadership quality to have when you have other people's lives in charge of you, not caring what happens to you. Yeah, for sure. But it gave me a sinking feeling because it let me. It didn't really give me an answer. I responded with, "Do you want to be married to me anymore?" And just very vague. This isn't a conversation that I want to have. So it's like I'm automatically going to assume the worst. I'm going to be like, okay, well, you pretty much told me what I needed to hear here, and that's kind of what the 2 days before I came back, I just. Probably talked to some of the guys that were with me at the time. I was very closed off from everybody. Just that state of disbelief, but there was that still a little bit of hope, but just a state of disbelief. Like, this isn't real, this isn't happening to me. And which a large part of that is ego. Being arrogant, like, oh, this could never happen to me. Because, obviously for her to feel that way, it's very, I want to believe, it's all her. It's all her. But, to have those sort of feelings, it had to be something the way that I was a husband, that wasn't right. So something I tell people, and I guess moving on from the questions, I talk about being just as thankful for those valley experiences as you are for the mountaintops. Yeah. Especially from a Christian standpoint, we're called to consider pure joy when we face trials and tribulations of all kinds. That's very hard to get across to somebody. That's like, that doesn't make any sense. Like to humans, it is very hard to make sense, I feel like. But I wasn't perfect, and I know now, what a husband is supposed to be. I've seen bad examples of it, not just from me, but from other people. Mm-hmm. And I've seen really great examples. I've seen amazing examples of people that I try to emulate, which, like members of our team, I want to try to emulate that and be a sponge and take that in. So I'm now very blessed, to have an amazing woman, my fiance Lindsay, coming into my life. I always say that, I say she saved me. That's how I always explain it. She saved my life. She reached out to me when I was in the hospital bed. I mean, we weren't dating or anything at the time. Like, I wasn't even, I didn't get my divorce papers until getting out of the hospital. But she sent me some scripture, and she's like, hey, I'm praying for you. Like, you're gonna get through this. I don't know verbatim what it is. I know I have it on my phone somewhere. But I was like, man, for this girl to say that, and then, a few weeks later, she's like, hey, once you're out of this, I want to come see you and spend time with you. And it's her explaining this is pretty funny, with her seeing her experience from it. Because at the time, I thought, there might be something wrong with this girl. Like, there might be something wrong, because I would not want to be given, if I was her, I wouldn't want to be in a 10-mile radius of me.
Yes.
What do I bring to the table? I'm a divorced man. I have felony charges against me. I have a job that I will eventually not have. And everybody knows, I have this black mark on me now that, like, I'm, who knows? Who knows what my future holds? But she kept coming to see me, and I was like, I could not. I was like, is this, like, this girl's, like, maybe she's a bit out of pity, like, she's trying, because I was very, I was
still doing
it. Yeah, exactly. I always knew of her. Her brother was one of my college teammates and one of my closest friends to this day. He had made a joke. We were at, I went up to visit him and some other buddies up in Columbus, Georgia at the time, and he was like, once everything's done for you in Savannah, like, you should ask my sister out or something. And I'm like, I know that you are, you're not sober right now, because you would never say that to me sober. It's like, oh, I'm serious. I'm like, all right. I mean, maybe we'll see. So I had messaged her a few times on Instagram, and just like, just dumb stuff. Yeah. And, you know, she then, you know, the next time I really heard from her, because I went down to a concert with a good buddy in like February before everything happened, and I was like, hey, I'm in, you know, your neck of the woods. And she was with some friends or something, and I was like, thank God she didn't meet up with me, because my intentions were nowhere near. Like, I was nowhere near I needed to be. And that could have absolutely ruined that for me. Yeah. One of my buddies that I was with said that. He's like, man, that's a blessing that she ended up not being there and didn't see you. And I was like, absolutely. Absolutely, because I was still dealing with that trauma and that pain, just trying to, you know, that outlet, you know, just how I fill this void in my life, you know, that quick, easy button, that pill, that, you know, just take the pill to make everything better, give me the answers to everything, like, that's what I was in search of. But, you know, after a while, it's funny to explain, because it's like, I had never really felt pursued, mm-hmm. really. And I felt that she was pursuing me. I couldn't figure out why, but I felt that love and pursuit. And I was like, obviously, you know, I'm going to pursue her,
yes,
for sure. And just like getting to really meet her family, you know, I couldn't imagine life without them too. And just having them in my life, and just the like the, you know, the people of faith that they are, mm-hmm. And for taking a love and that they show me. Like how they've been there for me these you know past year and a half, it's, you know, I could have never dreamed it up. I'm just extremely blessed for them.
Yeah, I have one more question. I think you touched on it in talking about suicide. You know, one of the things that our company really takes time to do is really share our story when we're out working with organizations, especially when we're working with the university here, the wrestling team. You said you were the guy who laughed at people. Now that you're on the opposite side of that, how do you view suicide, and what do you do to help reach out to individuals who are struggling with suicide?
That's a great question, brother. I mean, I think just the perspective of it, like I talked about, before I looked at it as a way of a cowardice move where you're taking the easy way out. I had seen that, and I had been affected by it too. I had, you know, I had known people and loved people that, you know, that had done that, or had, you know, or had thoughts. And because I know you guys have seen it yet, and even an army kind of stereotype is like, hey, the people that say that stuff are never the ones that do it. They're the ones that are out reaching for attention. You're like, all right, they're gonna say that, but the place you get to where it's a place of complete hopelessness. Mm-hmm. Like you feel that there's no other way, and it's a place of fear where you don't know the unknown, and you are completely convinced that this world will be a better place without you, and that everybody you know will be better off not having you around. Which, you know, like seeing the love that I get, you know, for, I was talking to you know, one of the athletes here today, and he started like, he's like, no way. He's like, Mom, he's like, I say, he's like, that's one of my favorite things to say. And I was like, I thought I made that up. I said, you know, I'm not a man of monetary wealth. I'm not wealthy in that meaning, but I'm a very wealthy man. I was like, and the way I measure my wealth is the love that I show and the reciprocation of that love that I get, especially the love of brothers. Mm-hmm. Which I'm extremely blessed and fortunate to have, and extremely wealthy in that sense that I define it. To answer the question about, you know, how do we address it, these people feel alone when they have these feelings. It's a place of complete being alone. And they think they're the only people that are going through this at the time, but if you need to be vulnerable with other people. People are afraid, and there's a stereotype about, you know, if you're a strong man, you can't be vulnerable with other people. You can't tell them these experiences you had or these feelings you had. You know, you're not a strong man if you've done that. Like, you know, you need to toughen up, or, you know, do you think that issue's bad, or I had to do this or that, and we compare trauma or something, but everybody has their giants, you know, just because you feel that yours is worse. And that was another thing I went to after everything happened to me. When I would hear problems from people, I'd be like, okay, all right, yeah, it's a terrible problem. Like, let me show you some real problems. Like, what a messed up way to look at that. Like, you know, everybody has their issue. Like, and it might affect other people more. And it's like, you know, you're not walking in their shoes. You don't know. It's just like how you show people love. It's like one of my mentors just shared with me, you know, a few days ago. He was telling me about, you know, to know someone or to love someone is to know them. You have to really know them. Like, he's like, you know, I can't explain to you, you know, I can tell you about my wife and I can tell you all things about her, but you can't, it's impossible for you to love her like I love her because you don't know her. Like, you don't know about her. And so how do you know about somebody and how do they know about you is being vulnerable with them, being able to talk to them. Like, if you're not able to do that and you're just locked up, you're not going to be, you know, you're not going to be able to truly know them and love them. And, you know, people need to know that, hey, they're not alone. Like, these feelings you have, they're not, you know, there are other people out there that have felt this. You know, it's not exclusive to you.
Which brings up a really good point. You'll get people that'll say, well, why would I listen to such a person? Why would I listen to a group of people if you got such these issues? Why? You know what I'm saying? Like, why are you the... That's just some people, right? Like, well, if I put on YouTube or TV, like, look at these other people, their lives are all put together, you know? But it's like you said, everybody's got a giant. The thing is, this group all came together for God knows whatever reason, right? But it's like...
There's a group of others on the phone.
I mean, sure. Yeah. No, but like everybody's vulnerable enough, right, to go out there and tell people. And I think out of all the opportunities we've gotten to speak to people, coming here to this university and talking to this team, it was like an absolute home run. Because they were able to look at you and be like, wow, a D1 wrestler is something I'm inspiring to be right now. And this is my life. This is my identity. Yeah. And when you were like, there's a lot of parallels between the military and what you're feeling right now. Trauma is trauma is trauma. You may not have experienced anything I did because you haven't lived as long. That's fine. That doesn't take away from what you have seen and I have seen. But you drew a lot of parallels to them, to the point that the kids staying after talking hours, right? Wanting to know more. Wanting to know, like, yeah, like, hey, I'm there now, or hey, I'm heading that way. And that's why you bring these people on. That's why, like, your story, we've put it up before, but like, people, bad things have happened to people, but it doesn't end there. Because you don't let it define you, like we always say. Hitting rock bottom doesn't define you. Your comeback story is what's going to define you. So regardless of what everybody says, regardless of what critics say and what people say, at the end of the day, your story is impacting people. That's what matters.
That's good. Well, I don't think I have anything else because you just closed it out really good. Thanks, Chef.
No. Hey, that's what you got. No, that's actually really, really good. You know, that's episode number 3 in our instructor series, talking to Gavin, getting to know him. Please share, like, subscribe, save. And if you're out there struggling with suicide, seriously having a hard time, reach out. Say something. If you know someone that's struggling with suicide, you know, show them that you care about them and love them because they need you. We thank you guys for tuning in, and we'll catch you in our next episode.